Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we take an in-depth look at Censored 2017, the 40th anniversary edition, and the top censored stories in media analysis of 2015 and 16. The new book, Censored 2017, is out on Seven Stories Press, and today we will be in conversation with the co-editor and associate director of the project, Dr. Andy Lee Roth. We'll be joined by Nolan Higdon, the contributor to the Junk Food News chapter, and independent journalist Manar Mahawish of Mint Press News joins the program to talk about her stories and media democracy in action. Please stay with us.
Created by the criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks on the bridges and the levees and the mines collapse.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we look at the latest release from Project Censored. It is Censored 2017, 40th Anniversary Edition, the top censored stories and media analysis of 2015 and 2016. And our first guest will be Dr. Andy Lee Roth. He is the associate director of Project Censored. He coordinates Project Censored's validated independent news program, and he has co-edited six previous editions of Project Censored yearbooks, in addition to contributing chapters on news photographs that depicted human cost of war and also the Military Commissions Act. Andy Lee Roth joins us by phone today. Andy Lee Roth, tell us about one of the main themes here that runs through not just Project Censored's work, but especially this year's volume.
Thank you, Mickey. We've dedicated this year's volume to the late Ben Bagdikian, the pioneering critic of the corporate media consolidation, a champion of the public's right to know, and in fact, a Project Censored judge for nearly 25 years. And people who heard Bagdikian speak in public or are familiar with his written work would have often heard him riff on the theme of media power is political power, right? To have power in the media is to have and to wield political power. And this is, as you suggest, certainly a theme running through Censored 2017, the latest yearbook, but also I think it in some ways is crystallization of a lot of what we at Project Censored are doing and trying to accomplish. Just to give one example of that, maybe start with a negative example of what media power is political power might look like. Listeners may remember the statement that was attributed to George W. Bush administration official in 2004, that when empire acts, it creates its own reality. And this unnamed Bush administration official, who's now widely believed to have been Karl Rove, spoke disparagingly of what he called, by contrast, the reality-based community. And Mark Danner, commenting on this, summed it up as, power has made reality its bitch. So that's one version of media power is political power. But I think we at Project Censored and the contributors to Censored 2017 are looking at what we might think of as a more affirmative version of the conception media power is political power. One way I think that that comes out is, what is the role of media, and particularly the news media, whether it be the corporate model of the news media or an independent alternative model, what is the role of that in shaping our expectations of democracy and what it means to participate in democracy? So that's a major theme in this year's book.
Yeah, indeed, Andy. And the dedication quote in the beginning, Bagdikian says, to give citizens a choice in ideas and information is to give them a choice in politics. If a nation has narrowly controlled information, it will soon have narrowly controlled politics. And Bagdikian wrote The Media Monopoly in the early 1980s, sounding the alarm bell when he said there are only 50 corporations controlling the media. Today, we're down to six controlling 90% of media in the United States. And indeed, we do have a narrowly controlled political structure.
Absolutely. And so, I mean, one of the things that he commented on when he produced the final version of his pioneering work, I believe it was 2004 that the new media monopoly came out, he quipped that the directors of the remaining corporate media entities that controlled the great majority of media in the United States, what most Americans have access to, would have fit in a small telephone booth, perhaps somewhat uncomfortably, but nonetheless in a telephone booth. And part of what he was talking about there is, I think, relates back to our 1987 number one story, which Bagdikian contributed to, where he made the trenchant comment that democracy is no longer a daily experience in most Americans' lives. And I've been thinking about that observation a lot. It may seem like in the midst of a presidential election campaign, you know, this is all people are talking about, it seems, Trump and Clinton and who will prevail and who will vote for. But I think if we take really seriously what Bagdikian was talking about when he says democracy is no longer a daily experience in our lives, the thing I've been thinking about is there's a difference between living in a democracy and participating in democracy. And if you think about living in a democracy, is in some ways it describes democracy then as an external condition or a habitat, right? It's like the environment we live in. And I suppose that version of it might work for what we're getting via the corporate media in terms of the current presidential election campaign. But to actually participate in democracy, and to participate not just in democracy on a, you know, 2 and 4 year cycle, but to participate it as Bagdikian called for on a daily basis, is a distinction or a goal, I think, that's at the heart of what we at Project Censored have been trying to do across the five decades of the project's existence, especially in the efforts to engage students on a daily basis in actively and systematically scrutinizing the corporate news content, and in turn, to the students playing an active role through the book, through the website, in their communities, in informing the public about the results of that research on the corporate content of corporate news. So, you know, I don't want to say that Censored 2017 or even the work of Project Censored is a silver bullet cure-all for restoring robust democracy in the United States, but I think it does get to, and this is part of why I'm so honored to be involved in the project, it does get to something that Bagdikian was writing about more than 25 years ago, about the need to make the experience of democracy a daily experience in most Americans' lives.
Hi, Andy, it's Peter Phillips. Certainly, Ben Bagdikian would look at this and understand that corporate media and their idea of democracy is which toothpaste to buy. And that's pretty much the only democracy we get when you go to the supermarket and you have several choices. But to have any kind of understanding that our democratic process, to be involved in it and have an impact on national and international policies is extremely limited, if not zero. And certainly he told me in the late 90s that he thought when he was at the Washington Post that probably 2/3 of all the stories at that time were coming from public relation firms or PR people inside of government. So most of the news was prepackaged and spun. We now know that that's much higher in the 80% or above range. And so this is corporate messages or spun messages in terms of certain interests in the world. And so that theme, I think, is very much part of the book this year.
I was just going to say, Andy, the story that you had alluded to from 1987, that's one of the things that Project Censored has done for years, is what's called Censored Deja Vu, looking back at past years. And in the 40th anniversary edition, our national judges went and selected what they thought were some of the more significant of the number one stories over the years. And that happened to be one of them. And those are cataloged in chapter 2 of the book, Censored Deja Vu, Strolling Down Memory Hole Lane, about stories that we forget about. And Bagdikian's, of course, was one of those stories. Coming up to the present in the 40th anniversary edition, Project Censored has been telling the news that it doesn't make the news for 40 years. And this year we have another top 25 list of these kinds of stories. And could you talk about the first story, the number one story, in fact, this year? Could you talk to listeners about that?
Yeah. So our number one story is that U.S. military forces are deployed in 70% of the world's nations. This is a story that was brought forward by Nick Terse, initially in Tom Dispatch, and subsequently with additional coverage in The Intercept and The Nation. And the heart of the story, in some ways, just to keep what is a complex and involved story relatively simple for the sake of our time, is that according to Special Operations Command, in 2015, There were special operations forces deployed in 147 of the world's 195 recognized nations. So that's our 70% figure. I think the historical perspective, even a near historical perspective, is important here. As Terse reported, that represents a nearly 80% increase since 2010. And when you look at the financial cost of that deployment, you see that it's quite significant. In 2015, the Special Operations Command budget funding had reached nearly $10 billion. That's an annual budget. Now, if you think about how this gets covered or not covered in the case, again, this is our number one most significant but underreported story for the 2015-2016 news cycle. Corporate media have not covered the massive expansion of special operations forces around the globe, much less given it a kind of critical assessment as to whether those missions are resulting in meaningful accomplishments. And I think one reason that this is so is that this is, in effect, the background to the kind of stories that the corporate media do cover, right? It's the unspoken background for the more dramatic reports of specific single military operations or policy decisions. For instance, one of the things we documented when we looked to see, well, what, if any, corporate coverage has Nick Terse's findings received, Time magazine ran a story that had a map of the world that showed nine places where U.S. military personnel are currently stationed. None of those were located in Africa on the Time magazine map, even though, as Nick Terse's reporting has documented, some of the most significant deployments of SOCOM forces overseas since 2006 have been in the African continent. So we see, at best, a kind of veiled, marginalized coverage of this. It's the taken-for-granted background. Of course, U.S. forces are operating everywhere. And I think it's important that that be treated as a story in its own right rather than a background context.
Andy, story number two in the book this year reminds me of, you know, if you watch television, the pharmaceutical ads are quite prevalent for every kind of ailment. There's a pill. But the medical research seems to be in doubt. Could you tell us a little bit more about story number two in the book this year?
Yeah, story number two is the crisis in evidence-based medicine. And one of our sources on this is actually the editor of The Lancet, a very prominent medical journal. Richard Horton is the journal's editor. And in April of 2015, he wrote in the lead editorial of that issue of The Lancet, he wrote, "Something has gone fundamentally wrong with one of our greatest human creations." He continued, "Much of the scientific literature, perhaps half, may simply be untrue." Now, Horton is not the first editor of a major journal, a major medical journal, to raise these concerns. In 2009, Marcia Angel, who was the editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, a former editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, had made similar claims, saying it's no longer possible to believe much of the clinical research that's published, or to rely on the judgment of trusted physicians or authoritative medical guidelines. And she pointed a clear finger at the way science is incentivized by the pharmaceutical industry's undue influence.
That's a very significant story.
In some ways, the most significant finding here, or the most significant reporting here, is coming from people like Charlie Cooper at The Independent in the UK and Sarah Bosley of The Guardian, also in the UK, who are reporting on the countervailing forces to this trend, right? Which include the launch of what is known as open data, an open data initiative that involves basically saying any pharmaceutical company that is conducting clinical trials on the efficacy of a drug in development needs to make the clinical trials publicly available to independent researchers for their evaluation. This component of the story is almost entirely unreported in U.S. corporate media. We have to turn to outlets like The Independent and The Guardian to get news on this new open data initiative. We found one instance in the Washington Post where the open data movement was mentioned in passing, but none of the specific initiatives were identified by name, much less discussed in any detail at all. So the corporate press have essentially ignored not only the crisis, but also one of the institutional mechanisms that might address the crisis.
Andy, one of the stories that my students found last year was about 1.5 million families in poverty in the U.S., very, very low level of poverty. Could you talk about that, story number six?
Yeah, that's the 1.5 million American families live on $2 per person per day or less. And this is reporting, always nice to have sociologists and their work represented in the top 25. This is reporting that's ultimately based on a study by two sociologists, Catherine Eden and Luke Schaefer, who published a book called $2 a Day, Living on Almost Nothing in America. And Yes Magazine ran a feature with an interview with the authors. The author of the Yes Magazine article said the depictions of poverty in the book read like a Dickens novel, and that therefore, because the U.S. media, the U.S. corporate media, seldom cover poverty and the experience of poor people in any kind of detail, that the results of Eden and Schaefer's study would be startling to many people. Just one example, Eden and Schaefer talk with a mother who is making plasma donations twice a week to provide the income that her family needs in order to have food on the table. And making plasma donations, for anyone who's done that, is far more complicated than making a blood donation. So this research is also, Eden and Schaefer's work is also a policy critique of the long-term consequences of President Bill Clinton's 1996 welfare reform initiative, which essentially tied welfare to employment, which works fine if the employment sector is doing its job, but when there simply are not jobs available to people, the result of welfare reform is that many people are not covered by that protective safety net, and they're left to do things like selling their plasma to feed their children.
Andy Lee Roth, Associate Director of Project Censored, your co-editor with me of Censored 2017, 40th Anniversary Edition. There are several stories here that we won't have time to cover in this program today, but we will certainly be doing other features on these. Among some of these stories, we have another update on Fukushima unending. We have another story on how the FBI has new plans to spy on high school students around the country. Climate change impact and gender inequality is another story. The New York Police Department caught editing Wikipedia on police brutality cases. I mean, again, there are so many of these stories. And just quickly to wrap up this segment, Andy, could you just tell our listeners a little bit about the process of how we go about looking at these stories and how many we reviewed this year? And again, you know, we want to remind our listeners that the way we define censorship is more broadly than traditional definitions, because these stories are covered places. It's just that they're woefully underreported on, and as you illustrated, often covered by either independent press or in foreign press rather than here by the corporate media.
Yeah. I mean, the process is a year-long, five-stage process, the upshot of which every story has been thoroughly vetted by the time it's posted, by the time it's included in the top 25. But I would say, as much as the process, and people can go online and read in nitty-gritty detail about the different stages of review, the point I would want to conclude on for today is to talk about the significance. Each of these stories that we've talked a little bit about today, or that Mickey has just mentioned, are important in their own right and deserve attention as individual stories. But to me, the most important thing of producing an annual list of stories, this top 25 list that Project Censored has produced since its founding in 1976, right? So we're talking about now a cumulative body of some 1,000 underreported but significant stories. The significant thing about them is how this represents a kind of systemic critique of the corporate media's blind spots and an equally systemic affirmation of the crucial role played by independent journalists and independent news organizations in the United States, right? And if you step back from the details of any one particular story and look at the list of stories as a whole and the cumulative 40 years of story lists, what you see is, in effect, the raw data that is behind the systemic critique of the corporate news media and how it fails to serve our interests as citizens and community members.
Indeed. Andy Lee Roth, co-editor of Censored 2017, 40th Anniversary Edition, also the associate director at Project Censored and professor of sociology at Citrus College. Andy Lee Roth, thank you for joining us on the Project Censored show today.
Thanks so much, Mickey. Thanks, Peter.
Thanks, Andy.
You can find more information about the top censored stories of this past year at projectcensored.org. After this musical break, we'll be back with Professor Nolan Higdon, who contributed to this year's Junk Food News and News Abuse chapter. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we're looking at the contents of Censored 2017, the 40th anniversary edition, out now on Seven Stories Press, edited by myself, by Andy Lee Roth, along with Project Censored. We have a foreword by Mark Crispin Miller and our cartoons by Khalil Bendib once again. And on the line with us right now, we have Professor Nolan Higdon, who has been contributing to Project Censored for a number of years. And the last few years, he's been the force behind Junk Food News and News Abuse. This year in the book on Chapter 3, The Corporate Media's War on Reality, Faux Elections and the Facade of Democracy. Nolan Higdon, you join us by phone.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
Nolan, tell us about some of the junk food news this year and the theme that you chose on the election primaries.
You know, some interesting forces came together to create the chapter this year. One major one was the 40-year anniversary, and Jensen had been inspired by the hijacking of the presidential election of Nixon. And at the same time, we were in the midst of our own form of presidential election here in the United States. And so we decided to write the junk food and news abuse chapter focusing on the 2016 presidential election. Most of our work in the book was dedicated to the primary election. And to be quite honest, the book kind of almost writes itself. It's so easy to spot junk food news in this supposed election cycle. But we mostly focused in the junk food portion of the chapter, which I'll remind listeners, junk food are these non-newsworthy stories that distract from newsworthy stories. We found that the rise of Donald Trump to be emblematic of junk food news, and that any comment he made, he was covered at length. In fact, he had three times the amount of coverage of Hillary Clinton. $2 billion in free coverage of Trump. And kind of one of the most revealing episodes we talk about in the chapter is Bernie Sanders had won on primary night, and he was going to give his speech, but the major networks didn't cut to Sanders' speech. Instead, they showed an empty podium because they were waiting for Trump to arrive. And that was just sort of emblematic of the junk food news cycle that Trump has dominated in the last year in the United States. And to be quite honest, is also responsible for the rise of Trump, that he actually leads one of these major parties and has remained somewhat of a contender for presidency of the United States.
Nolan Higdon, one of the parts of the chapter in Junk Food News this year on the Trump card talks about how Donald Trump was covered as a junk food news story years ago and was a, you know, reality television personality and so forth. And we see a lot of that bleed over into the presidential campaign and the infotainment side of media coverage in American politics. And one statement was quite striking that I wanted to share with listeners. Right in the book about CBS, the chairman of the board, the president, Les Moonves, who was at a conference in San Francisco at a broadcasting conference, and he admitted to the crowd there that the Trump coverage led to increased profits. And he said, quote, "I've never seen anything like this, and this is going to be a very good year for us. Sorry. It's a terrible thing to say, but bring it on, Donald. Keep going. It may not be good for America, but it's damn good for CBS." Even though 75% of Americans agreed that corporate media were covering Trump far too much, far too often.
Again, just such an egregious example. These news agencies are supposed to inform the American public about these elections. And generally speaking, you know, most journalists like to posit themselves as rising above the reality show fodder to do some critical coverage. But this whole news cycle was so dedicated to reality television that, you know, it's left a lot of us wondering, you know, was Trump actually running for president, or was he trying to use this as a publicity stunt to launch his various failed businesses? But, you know, to even sort of further underscore what you were pointing to there, even people who have worked in establishment reporting, like Andrew Sullivan and Keith Olbermann and Greta Van Susteren, even they came out just disgusted with what was going on in the news coverage of Trump. So even insiders were disgusted by what was going on in the corporate press. And we document that in the book as well. But as you also point to, there were a lot of profits in Trump. Trump drew a lot of attention. And you know, we've reported for years in Project Censored that these junk food stories or this attention launches candidacies. And Trump was an example of that. Trump benefited from this round-the-clock coverage. But I would doubt the American public will say they benefited from this coverage. In fact, as you pointed out, 75% of Americans agree that there was too much coverage of Trump.
That's certainly one of the core issues in this chapter and that you lay out. Nolan, junk food news has always been a fun thing for students to engage in and write. They get very creative with it. Going back, I remember in the mid-2000s, the death of Jean-Benet Ramsey, the little girl, child beauty queen. occupy the news to a great extent. When that story came up, we had to think about that and go, well, it wouldn't be right to call this a junk news story because it's certainly an important story, but it was so covered almost daily for months. So we came up with this idea, well, this is a story that's been abused, news abuse. Now, we use that kind of catch-all to look at stories that are propaganda-based or news abuse. What did you find in this year's book?
The second part of the book, chapter, Junk Food News Abuse This Year, is dedicated to the coronation of Hillary Clinton. The Clinton was coronated by the corporate press to be the nominee for the Democratic Party. And keep this in mind to your listeners and readers. We wrote this prior to these email leaks. And so it was interesting to see how everything we had confirmed by looking at news stories and paying attention to interviews and watching the news cycles was then confirmed when these emails were released. And in fact, the Democratic Party was working with the corporate press to coronate Clinton as the nominee for the Democratic Party. I think we can say that with some certainty. And so we found many examples of this news abuse throughout the previous year's cycle. In addition to calling her the front runner even when she was tied or behind in the polls, other forms of news abuse, they try to redefine progressivism, and we talk about this at length in the book, that Hillary Clinton starts to be defined as the progressive. I mean, they wipe away a lot of history in a lot of Clinton's history on things like crime bill and human rights abuses, her coziness with Wall Street.
In fact, Nolan, she was dubbed the progressive who gets things done.
When her Wall Street speeches were released in the last week, even there she admits she calls herself a centrist. So all of her past we can point to, she's not a progressive. We have her admitting she's not a progressive. But once Bernie Sanders on a somewhat progressive platform started improving in poll numbers, then all of a sudden Clinton was labeled, yeah, the progressive who can get things done. This is managed news that's done on purpose. No one can really look at the history of Hillary Clinton and call her a progressive unless you have some ulterior motive. And in this case, the ulterior motive was to get her the nomination for the Democratic Party as the presidential candidate.
And you can't really call that junk food news. Certainly Donald Trump's coverage was junk food, but you can't call that coverage of Hillary. But that was an abuse of truth and certainly a story that was managed top down.
Absolutely. And like I said, you know, readers will read this and then be amazed that we did this prior to these email leaks, that we were able to find this information just purely by watching the news cycle and doing what Project Censored's always done. And it was a really good confirmation of the work that Project Censored does that was then backed up by these emails. News abuse, for sure. The corporate press working with political parties to manage our elections. That's why we again call this like faux democracy or facade of democracy.
All right, and the spelling of democracy has an M-O-C-K in it as mocking the process. The chapter always has kind of a pithy, tongue-in-cheek kind of approach for things. That's pithy with a T-H. The chapter concludes, Nolan, and I wanted to segue into this one more thing to talk about. As the book was going to publication, a Harvard study by Thomas Patterson was released. Harvard's Bradley Professor of Government and the Press, in conjunction with the Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy, they drew many of the same conclusions as Project Censored regarding unequal and biased coverage during the 2016 primary season. And again, as you illustrated before, now that we've seen these WikiLeaks documents, it's even further support of the notion that the media has been completely biased and in fact continues to be so.
These are all independent studies that are done that are drawing the same conclusion. And that becomes a really powerful tool. And in fact, when we were going to publication, we had a third portion of this chapter that we have now put online, which you can read it at projectcensored.org and bcml.org. We talked about sort of what is going to be the impact of managing this election, because there was this excitement among millennials who participated in this election.
This is what I wanted to look at for the last segment here on this issue, is that we did research on this war on social justice and the impact on millennial generation and the way that corporate media has been very biased in their coverage against millennials. So talk about the research.
Junk food, we know, distracts from newsworthy stories, and news abuse carefully crafts narratives to manipulate public opinion. And so in this third segment that we have online, we noted that the junk food and news abuse distracted and or undermined stories of social justice. And so we specifically looked at some of these stories that are tied to contemporary youth movements, and the youth we point to are the millennial generation. And so stories, for example, of race were trivialized, stories of sexism, human rights, climate change. These stories were either ignored or trivialized to launch the candidacies of Trump and Clinton. And I found this to be a very concerning outcome of the election because you have the millennials, these youths that are so involved with these movements, and these issues are important to them. And this generation's already been attacked for supposedly being lazy and checked out. But here they did. They participated in this election in a big way, overwhelmingly supporting Bernie Sanders. Bernie took home over 60% of the youth vote, some states 80%. It wasn't that they didn't participate. It's that their vote was completely ignored. These political parties managed the election to marginalize the youth. And so my question is, I'm very interested in the 2020 election and future elections of how the youth are going to react. By 2020, millennials are going to make up 36% of the voting populace. And so this is kind of the last round for the baby boomers to dominate our elections. It's up to kind of the millennials in 2020. And I think that's a really critical point to make because Clinton and Trump are kind of the fruition of this baby boomer generation that turned the party of Eisenhower into the party of Trump and the party of FDR into the Clinton corporate pay-to-play meritocracy. And so it's interesting to see that these baby boomers are generation is maintaining this power in these two figures, yet this challenge coming from the millennials. And that's kind of where we leave off when this election goes, is one of these candidates is going to be named for the president. And it's concerning. Will millennials take this as an opportunity to organize and challenge the system and change it? Or will they become self-fulfilling and become apathetic and sort of check out of the system because they know it's managed at some level?
Nolan Higdon, the current narrative from the parties and certainly the corporate news media, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, just did a story on this the other day, and this is certainly a theme that you've been looking at for some time and that we've been looking at this particular year, both in the book, in 2017 censored book, and online in other articles. And that's the way that it's now being spun, that somehow millennials and their lack of education and awareness or apathy is responsible for the rise of Trump, which really makes no sense at all. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, this is just laughable. Let's remind people here, this is also the generation that sort of walked off and accepted the election of George W. Bush. They now have evidence, glaring evidence, that parties and media worked to launch the candidacy of Hillary Clinton. And now they're attacking millennials, telling them they need to vote for Hillary Clinton, someone who was not elected by the people. The people were manipulated in this process to get her the nomination. And you know, my advice for young people would be don't buy into the system and treat her like a legitimate candidate. Challenge her candidacy for this party manipulation. Furthermore, these candidates are coming from the generation that gave us the first two unpaid wars in U.S. history, the greatest financial collapse of the Great Depression, and deregulation and protecting against things like race inequality and gender inequality, et cetera. And then they have the audacity to tell young people how to vote. Hillary's proposing adding three more years of work to collect Social Security. So it seems like it's always shuffling everything on the youth to pay for the mistakes of this generation.
And Nolan Higdon, go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. Oh, yeah. So my advice would be not to buy into that narrative if I was a young person. I would show up to vote to show you're not apathetic or lazy, but continue to challenge the system.
Now, Nolan, you know, Black Lives Matter, Occupy Wall Street, the Fight for 15, the youth climate movement, the Dreamers, LGBTQI, you know, a lot of these are youth movements or youth strong movements. So the notion that millennials get painted in such a stereotypical way is, as you said, laughable. But again, it's definitely inaccurate. It's definitely a ploy to marginalize young people. And as you say, the millennial generation is going to be the largest voting bloc, bigger than baby boomers, even coming up for 2020. So it's certainly going to be something that we'll be paying attention to at Project Censored, and I'm sure you'll be sort of spearheading that front.
Absolutely. I'm normally not such an optimistic person, but I'm very optimistic about this generation. Young people are getting out there. They are doing things. They are thinking in new ways. I'm optimistic about the future in this generation.
And it certainly terrifies the baby boomer power elites in both government and corporations that young people can mobilize, can engage. Certainly the CIA and the Secret Service and FBI were all over the Occupy movement, infiltrated everywhere. They're worried that millennials will, in fact, really continue to engage, and they have quite thoroughly.
Absolutely. I mean, even when we have these protests that are going on in different sporting events, not just the NFL, but sporting events around the country are costing some of these major corporations billions in advertising dollars because they're not showing these national anthems because people are turning off their television. So there's a lot of exciting things going on right now around this generation, and it is challenging our power structures. But I'd encourage youth, or remind youth, I guess, that these changes don't happen fast. These movements need to connect, they need to be sustained, and they need to continue moving forward.
Professor Nolan Higdon, you are behind the Junk Food News, News Abuse chapter. You worked with many students at several colleges and universities, and I worked with you on some of these works, and also a new piece that's going to be up here at projectcensored.org and the Global Critical Media Literacy Project at gcml.org. So listeners can go online and be looking for some of the research that we were just discussing. Nolan, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you both very much. Great to hear from both of you.
Up next on the Project Censored Show, we'll speak with one of the millennial generation journalists. We'll be joined by Manar Mohawish of Mint Press News, who has contributions in Censored 2017. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today's program looks at Censored 2017, the 40th anniversary edition. We heard from co-editor and associate director of the project, Andy Lee Roth, who was talking about some of the top censored stories of the year. We just heard from Nolan Higdon, who helped contribute to the Junk Food News News Abuse chapter. And now we're joined by Manar Mohawish. She is an independent journalist. She's the founder of Mint Press News. Manar has a story in our top 25 this year on Syria, and she's joining us today by phone to talk about her work. Manar Mohawish, thank you for joining us on the Project Censored Show today.
Thank you for having me, Mickey. Excited to be here.
So, Manar, tell us about your contribution to the book this year, particularly from Chapter 4. We do something called Media Democracy in Action. And, you know, as James Baldwin wrote, not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it's faced. And the gist of this chapter each year in the books highlights the important work of independent journalists and pro-democratic organizations that really try to make a difference in the world. And this year, we include Abby Martin from the Empire Files, Darcy Rakestraw, Food and Water Watch, Susan Rahman of College of Marin, a longtime contributor about service learning education, Eric Dratzer of Stop Imperialism, and Peter B. Collins, great radio host, and you, Manar Mohawish of Mint Press News. Tell our listeners about why you founded Mint Press News and how you describe what you do there.
I have a very, I guess you could say, rare perspective that we have brought to the independent media world. You know, we talk a lot about the war machine and our economy being driven by a military and war economy. I actually grew up in Palestine and lived under Israeli occupation and apartheid, which, as you know, is funded by the United States. And I witnessed war crimes being committed against humanity. I witnessed laws that divided an entire nation based on religion. And I would go to school regularly in Palestine, two kids not, you know, showing up in our classroom because they were being denied an education. They were being denied entry. They were being blocked at Israeli checkpoints. And so when I had come back to the United States, where I was actually born in the United States, when I had come back in 2001, just a few months before September 11th, I witnessed the media basically present the conflict in Palestine as this equal level playing field, you know, Muslim versus Jew. And they presented it in the narrative that we're all too familiar with, which is this religious narrative. And it was never presented in a way that exposed or explained the true historical concept of Israel being a colonialist power and an apartheid state that was committing genocide against Palestinians. And so I had watched the media basically become this lapdog for this military industrial complex and demonizing Palestinians and Muslims alike. And of course, right after September 11th, which occurred just a couple of months after we had returned, I then again, at the age of 12 years old, witnessed the media beat the drums of war by dehumanizing Muslims and Palestinians and people of the Middle East all over again to justify war and aggression abroad. And so through these experiences, of course, I felt helpless at the time and had suffered from PTSD from living under Israeli occupation. But I also had this sense of hope that, you know, the only way that we can really change the narrative and get Americans to realize the destruction that our military is basically doing across the world is to become the media. And so that's when I took it upon myself to become a journalist, to study journalism. And that has been basically my journey to start Mint Press. And since we started Mint Press, we have really taken a huge focus on the military-industrial complex and looking at how special interests do drive policies, not only at home, but abroad.
Minar, hi, this is Peter Phillips, and it's certainly shocking that so much money, $38 billion, has just been assigned to Israel over the next 10 years. And it's just amazing to us that that helps keep that war machine alive. One of your stories made its way all the way to the top 10 this year out of a couple 300, and you were voted high, and it's story number 8 about Syria.
Wow.
And the contest for gas delivery in Europe, and not just all Muslim sectarianism. So tell us a little bit about that story.
Well, as you know, most conflicts in the Middle East are always presented in the media as this religious sectarian war. We always hear this line that, oh, they've been killing each other for thousands of years. And it's really just a dehumanization tactic to make the people in the Middle East look really like uncivilized and killable is the way that we describe it. And so since the beginning, the onset of the Syria civil war, since 2011, when the CIA was on the ground training these anti-government protests and basically fomenting a coup there, Mint Press has actually been at the forefront of providing coverage to show that this is not a genuine revolution. Although there always, in every country, there's going to be some sort of anti-government movement. The one that we see in Syria brewing today is basically an invasion. And so we've been at the forefront of covering this story. And part of our coverage has been to look at the economic interests by the West, the corporate and bankster interests of basically sanctioning Russia's economy. Now, Russia is a major player in the BRICS nations. It's a member of the BRICS nations. And so they're obviously a major player in the gas and oil industry in the world, especially in its providing of gas for the European market. And so when we covered the conflict in Syria, we know that the United States and its allies don't just get involved for the reasons of human rights. There's always going to be an economic impetus for these conflicts, especially at the rate that they're being involved in. And so we looked at how Russia was basically creating a gas plan with Syria and Iran to get Iranian gas into the European market. But of course, this poses a very, very huge setback for major oil-producing nations like Saudi Arabia, and it also poses a huge economic threat to the current infrastructure of oil and gas producers around the world, which are basically owned by, you know, British and other Western corporations. And so we basically provided that coverage to show that the crisis in Syria is maybe on the surface it appears to be a sectarian conflict, but at the root of it, Syria has been basically the target of a proxy war between the United States and Russia to basically sanction Russia's economy, to make sure that Russia does not have a footprint in the oil and gas industry.
Minar Mahoush, you've covered many issues in the Middle East in particular, and Mint Press News has really, as you said, kind of been on the front lines of a lot of these stories. And you yourself have, in fact, been the target of critics both left and right. And the fact that you are, you know, a millennial generation, a woman, also Muslim, that seems to have contributed to some of the attacks that you've experienced and efforts to censor you.
Right. I mean, how often do we hear Muslim women are oppressed, they're non-intelligent, they can't speak up for themselves, and here we are in the U.S., there's this Muslim woman wearing hijab, and she's standing up to the corporate empire, providing an alternative perspective on what's really happening in the Middle East. And I actually found myself to be a victim of an organized smear campaign a couple of years ago that was conducted against me by the most notorious neocons in the industry that are basically the architects of war within the media. You know, I was targeted by BuzzFeed. One of their major reporters, Rosie Gray, is known to push Russia-phobia and Cold War rhetoric as well as Islamophobia. And she's very much tied to these neocon think tanks. A lot of her coverage comes directly from the National Endowment and other military think tanks that work very close with other neocons like Michael Wise, who now runs The Daily Beast, and Ellie Lake, and now the new editor of The Atlantic, Jeffrey Goldberg. And so these are the very people who are pushing this Cold War rhetoric to put the United States up against war with Russia, the next Cold War. And Mint Press News, as an independent media organization, we took it upon ourselves to challenge that narrative. And it became literally a David and Goliath kind of situation where our coverage on Syria has made international headlines, and it helped stop the initial U.S. war in Syria a few years ago when Assad had supposedly crossed that red line by gassing his own people. And, of course, we said that, hey, it's the rebels, the Syrian rebels, Al-Qaeda rebels very specifically, who have the capabilities to produce sarin gas. And they're trying to flip the narrative that Assad is killing his own people. And we provided that alternative coverage to challenge that.
Well, Manar, again, this isn't to say that Assad hasn't been behind other atrocities or other things in Syria. This is one of the big fallacies that goes on, is that because you go and attempt to really get the facts behind these issues and you don't play into the exterior narrative, the binaries, right? Because you say some of the things you say, there's this strange assumption that you're pro-Assad, and then by definition and connection and guilt by association, you must be pro-Putin. So right. I guess if we follow that narrative, if you're pro-Putin, you must be pro-Trump.
That's really how the narrative has been playing out if you challenge these war narratives. I didn't say that very specifically. But that's what it is you get labeled as if you are pro-Assad and pro-Putin. Of course, these are just like any other leaders. They've committed their own crimes. There's always going to be corruption in their governments. And we're not saying that they're not. We're just saying that, hey, there's more to the story that's not being told.
Mint Press is certainly one of many hundreds of independent news sources throughout the world. I require my students to subscribe to independent news sources on a daily basis. Tell us about how you started Mint Press and what areas do you focus on?
Mint Press really actually started out as my blog when I was freelancing. And like I was saying before, one of the true reasons I started Mint Press is because I lived under the war machine in Israel and Palestine, and I witnessed those crimes being committed against an unarmed population. And just watching the media continuously feeding us with this junk food news, top 10 headlines of this or top 10 stories of this, it really, really encouraged me to start my own media organization to challenge corporate media. Today, we do have six corporations that control over 90% of what Americans see, hear, and read. And that's not an exaggeration. Most people get their news from these major organizations, and they don't even realize that they're being fed public relations. And so knowing that what we're getting is public relations, that really inspired me to get Mint Press started and really focus on long-form journalism. We do have some daily news, but our main focus is long-form journalism because right now we have a lot of snippets in that junk food style news. It doesn't really have any depth to it. And so now is the time to kind of take a step back and say the media that we have now is not truly working in the interest of the public. We need to go back and really provide a journalism, a platform that really informs the public to really equip us, the American public, with the information that we need to make better decisions at the voting polls. I mean, look where we have now. We have Donald Trump, who is a sexual predator. He's a racist. And then we have Hillary Clinton, who is a war criminal and who's a liar for a living. These are our two options. And a lot of that has to do with our complicity in this. And not to put all the blame on us, the people, but it's the media that is feeding us these two candidates, and it's time that we put the power back in our hands through education, through real information, so that we can hold our government accountable, I guess you could say.
Manar Mahawish, you are speaking at the Project Censored 40th Anniversary Celebration and Media Freedom Summit And you'll be in conversation with Abby Martin of the Empire Files, David Talbot, the founder of Salon.com, also best-selling author of The Devil's Chessboard on Alan Dulles and the CIA. Also, Mark Crispin Miller, the New York University scholar, will be joining in that conversation. Mark Crispin Miller wrote the foreword for Censored 2017 this year. So October 21st, that's the Project Censored anniversary, and that will be recorded for people to see later. But if you're local to Northern California, you should come to Sonoma State University for that event. You can learn more at projectcensored.org. The Friday night celebration is 5 to 8:30, and the October 21st, 22nd conference is all day Friday, Saturday at Sonoma State University with a detailed list of panels and workshops and speakers. It's a very participatory happening, celebrating media freedom, celebrating critical media literacy education, and the great independent journalists like yourself, Manar, and the work that you do and Abby Martin does and so many other people. People can get more information at projectcensored.org, and students are admitted to the summit for free. We want to stress that. We want to see a lot of young people, millennials and students, come out and really be part of this. Project Censored for 40 years has been a lot about education, has been a lot about trying to help another generation of citizen journalists and people do what you just described, Manar, speaking truth to power, and speaking truth is power. And we thank you so much for the work that you do at Mint Press News. Manar Mahawish, could you tell our listeners how to find out more about Mint Press News?
They can visit our website, of course, at mintpressnews.com, and then we're very active on social media, so we have our Facebook page and also our Twitter page at both Mint Press News.
Mint Press News. So thank you very much, Manar Mahawish, and we're certainly looking forward to the Media Freedom Summit and celebration on October 21st.
Thank you.
And for the final segment of the Project Censored show today, we're joined by the intrepid independent journalist Greg Palast. He is talking about a re-release, an updated version of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, which is a book by Seven Stories Press, as well as a documentary film. Greg Palast, tell us about what's going on in your world.
This is a film for a full run in San Francisco. 1,000 members of KPFA jammed in for a single night to see The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, a tale of billionaires and ballot bandits. That was back in Oakland. That was just a preview with an unfinished film. Now you got the full thing, brand new. And the film features, even though it's a so-called documentary, because it's a nonfiction film, we're in the Documentary Academy Award category, it is featuring Rosario Dawson, Shailene Woodley, you know, the star of Snowden. Willie Nelson's in there. Ice-T is in there. So is Richard Belzer, that is Detective Munch, who comes out. The Belzer and Ice-T in their roles from Law & Order pop out of a TV screen to help me on my investigation into the theft of the November election. You say, what? Yep, I've got the info, I've got the documents, I've got the inside stuff, and I confront the billionaires who have paid for this heist in November. Remember, Donald Trump only plays a billionaire on TV. The real billionaires behind him, like JP the Foreclosure King and the Vulture, these are real billionaires who are funding this vote heist. You'll see how it's done. It'll make you laugh. It'll make you cry. It'll make you act. If you don't laugh and cry, I personally will pay for your therapy. Got a standing ovation from 1,000 KPFA subscribers who saw the film before it was even finished a few weeks ago in Oakland. Now it's the real thing at a regular theater with surround sound, the whole bit, music by Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and Mario Grigoroff. Lots of fun, lots of horror.
So these showings of your film, Best Democracy Money Can Buy, are going to be at the Presidio Theater in San Francisco, October 14th through next Thursday, October 20th.
That's right. We're going to have a lot of your celebs. We'll definitely have Dennis Bernstein, Jello Biafra, and we've invited my special guest, Boots Riley, the Coup, and others. And obviously we have some superstars from the film, and usually one or two sneak in. I got Jackson Brown in the other day. We'll have some good people. It's not the usual documentary. It's not the Petroleum Broadcast System documentary of white guys in front of bookshelves. It is on-the-go, real undercover investigative reporting done in real time, including shots taken from a camera sewn into my hat. None of this stuff is made up. It's a 100% true film. People keep saying, what's made up? Nothing, except for Santa Claus. There is no Santa Claus. It's actually Ed Asner in a Santa outfit who's explaining how JP, the foreclosure king's, Donald Trump's money bags, fixed the mortgage market to personally swipe $5 billion.
Greg Palast, we're going to have to cut it there, and we encourage people to see The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. Greg, can you give a website so people can find out more?
Yeah, always go to gregpalast.com, G-R-E-G-P-A-L-A-S-T, gregpalast.com, or thebestdemocracymoneycanbuy.com. It'll refresh your mind. The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, a tale of billionaires and ballot bandits. You couldn't get more sickened while having more fun.
Greg Palast, thanks for coming back on the Project Censored show, and wish you all the best.
You got it.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaigns.
And that does it for another episode of the Project Censored show today. I'd like to make a couple quick announcements. One is the Project Censored 40th Anniversary and Media Freedom Summit that will be held at Sonoma State University October 21st and 22nd. That's at Sonoma State University in Rohnert Park, California. You can learn more at projectcensored.org. There is a Friday night celebration that's open to the public with Abby Martin, Manar Mahawish, Mark Crispin Miller, and David Talbot. Go online to projectcensored.org to find out more and register for the conference, a two-day event celebrating and discussing media freedom. Students are admitted for free. The Project Censored show airs on 35 stations around the United States. To learn more, you can go to projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. Special thanks goes to our producer, Anthony Fest, Erica Bridgman, our engineer. We'll see you next time.